Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Revolution Health Radio Show, brought to you by ChrisKresser.com. I'm your host, Steve Wright from STDLifestyle.com, and with me is integrative medical practitioner, licensed acupuncturist, and healthy skeptic, Chris Kresser. How's it going in the Bay Area, man?
I feel like I almost wouldn't know. It's been pretty crazy for me around here, just getting the high cholesterol action plan out the door, and my daughter Sylvie is teething and has had a pretty brutal cough for about a week, and she's recovering well, but she's been keeping her mom and dad up at night. So I'm going to practice what I preach, and we're going to do a shorter show today so I can take some time to just chill out a little bit.
Well, I can't say I've been there, but I completely understand.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I had a sort of vague idea of what it would be like before I got into it. I had six nieces and nephews, and so I saw a little bit of it behind the scenes. But it's certainly different when you're the one getting up and, you know, changing that diaper or whatever. Yeah,
doing it. Yeah. The act of doing it is different than thinking about it. I think you had a quote about that somewhere.
That's absolutely true. Yeah. But we got some good questions. We'll get into as many of them as we can, and then we'll be back in a couple weeks full strength.
Yep. This is going to be the ladies' show. And in the meantime, Chris, go take a nap. I'm going to tell the listeners about Beyond Paleo. So if you're new to this radio show, if you're new to the paleo diet, or you're just interested in optimizing your health, you're going to want to check out what Chris has put together. It's an email series, 13 parts in total, and it covers Chris's best tips on burning fat, boosting energy, and preventing and reversing disease without drugs. It's called Beyond Paleo, and you can sign up at ChrisKresser.com in the big red box. All right, Chris, wake up. Time to go.
All right, I'm back. I'm here.
Okay.
Got my green tea.
Awesome. Well, let's get started. This first question comes from Tori. She says, I'm a 41-year-old female. For years, I've used the standard American gynecologist and have always followed their advice. But as I educate myself more on health, the status of the American health system, etc., I now have doubts about the advice that I was getting from the OBGYN. I know that I'm about to face quite a few hormonal changes with pending menopause. What would be your recommendation on such things as annual mammograms and pap smears for ongoing health monitoring as I move from pre through postmenopausal?
Yeah, this is a controversial issue. Seems like we've been talking a lot about those lately, and seems like there are a lot of those in the health and nutrition world. But so the background on this is that in 2009, the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force recommended pretty dramatic changes to the breast cancer screening guidelines that were in place up until then. And the proposed new guidelines recommend starting regular screening later at age 50 rather than at age 40, which was the previous recommendation. And then they recommend screening before age 50 only for women who are at much higher than average risk of breast cancer. And then the new guidelines also called for mammograms to be done every other year instead of every year, as the previous guidelines suggested. So there's been a lot of debate about this, and there are, you know, pretty prominent groups like breastcancer.org that have strongly objected to the new guidelines, and they lay out a few reasons why they think they're not a good idea. So number one, the analysis of the task force was based on older mammography techniques, meaning the researchers mostly looked at the results from film mammograms instead of digital mammograms, which are known to be a lot more accurate. The analysis was based on some inaccurate assumptions about optimal treatment after breast cancer is diagnosed. For example, it's assumed that women diagnosed with hormone receptor positive early stage breast cancer would receive and benefit from hormonal therapy, but not chemotherapy, even though there's some data that many of those women do receive and benefit from chemo after surgery. So assumptions like that may have caused the researchers to underestimate the number of lives that would be lost if the proposed changes were put into effect. The analysis also didn't adequately consider the combined benefit of early detection with current screening guidelines and new treatments that have resulted in improving survival rates in recent years. And their point is kind of that screening can't be looked at in isolation as a snapshot. It happens as we continue to improve both diagnosis and treatment. But you can't, of course, treat what isn't diagnosed.
This is breastcancer.org's refuting?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And then they also claim that the proposed changes would mean that a lot of breast cancers would be diagnosed at later stages, which make them a lot harder to treat. And the survival rates, of course, decrease the later that they're diagnosed. Because when you're diagnosed at a later stage, it's more likely that it could evolve into metastatic cancer that spreads to other parts of the body. And then lastly, they claim that the proposed changes would mean that younger women would be diagnosed later. And breast cancer in younger women tends to be more aggressive than it is in older women. So early diagnosis and treatment is more critical for them. So in contrast to the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, the breastcancer.org group recommends that if you're 40 or older and you have an average risk of breast cancer, they do recommend yearly screening mammograms. And then if your breast cancer risk is higher than average, they even suggest talking to your doctor about a more aggressive breast cancer screening plan that may include breast MRI or ultrasound in addition to mammograms. So I'm not sure, frankly, where I come down on this at this point. I feel like I need to investigate it further before I can make any kind of recommendation. I've started to wade into it several different times, but I quickly realized that I wasn't going to be able to reach a kind of coherent conclusion just in a few hours of reviewing the research. It's a pretty vast topic, and like a lot of these topics, there's a lot more than meets the eye. So the best I can do at this point is direct people to the breastcancer.org site. They have a pretty interesting discussion of the U.S. Preventative Task Force recommendations. I think in general, where I tend to come down on these screening tests is perhaps with an appreciation of the risk involved in some of the screening tests, the exposure to radiation. The other thing to consider is, and this is like more true with prostate screening, for example, is the additional treatment that often comes from additional screening and the risks associated with that additional treatment. So again, I'll just have to keep digging before I can make a recommendation, but check out breastcancer.org as an alternative viewpoint. And it's something that you probably are going to have to run through your own filters too, because everyone has different risk tolerance and threshold with this kind of thing. Some people are quite comfortable not, you know, we talked about this in the context of raw milk. Like there are some people who, if there's a 1 in 100,000 chance of them contracting an illness or serious disease from eating a food or drinking something, they feel absolutely fine doing that. They're not concerned about that. But for other people, even a 1 in 100,000 chance is enough to scare them away from doing that. So there's some element of that here. It's each individual risk tolerance and you know, how that, what kind of sense these guidelines make for you will have to be run through that filter. So let's talk a little bit about pap smears, because I think it's not quite as controversial as the breast cancer guidelines. In the 1930s, cervical cancer was actually the deadliest cancer for women in the U.S. At that time, it killed more women each year than breast cancer or lung cancer. But over the past 80 years, there's been a huge decline in the death rate from cervical cancer because of improvements in treatment and screening. And today, death from cervical cancer is relatively rare in the U.S. So in March of, I think it was this year, the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, same group, announced new recommendations for pap tests to screen women for cervical cancer. And the guidelines advise women to reduce the number of tests they receive over their entire lifetime to ensure that they get the benefits of testing while minimizing the risks. And so there was one big change in their recommendations, which is that women under the age of 21 shouldn't be tested. Women over 21 should undergo a pap screening test every 3 years instead of annually, which was their previous recommendation. because HPV can take more than a decade to progress to cervical dysplasia or cancer. So their recommendations now are that all women should start screening at age 21. It used to be that screening was recommended 3 years after starting vaginal intercourse, but they've backed away from that. Women aged 21 to 29 should get a pap test every 3 years. For women 30 and over, pap tests should be done every 30 years. And the guidelines recommend against annual or more frequent pap testing in that age group. And they suggest combining the pap test with HPV testing every 3 to 5 years for women 30 years and older. So I haven't seen much controversy about the changes in those guidelines, so I don't see really any reason not to follow them in the case of pap tests.
Well, thanks for clearing those things up. I know that's going to help a lot of people. And
you know, we'll do an update in the future if I... once I have a chance to look into it a little further.
Yeah, I'm sure that everybody will be very grateful when you do get a chance to dive into the breast cancer research. So, okay, well, we have a slew of questions here that were asked by men and women alike. Just a lot of questions that all kind of were grouped together. And so I just am going to go ahead and say that these questions are from the crowd because I whittled them down to one-line statements, and then Chris is going to go ahead and tackle them one by one. So I want to thank everybody who sent these in. I apologize if I trimmed your name off. So the first one from the crowd is... what happens when you're pregnant and you're going to get a UTI or a bacterial vaginosis? How do you handle this? And is it going to hurt the baby?
Yeah, that's a good question. I get that a lot. Bacterial vaginosis, or BV as we're going to refer to it for convenience sake, is really common. Current studies suggest that the prevalence of BV among non-pregnant women is something like 15% to 30%. And up to 50% of pregnant women have been found to have BV. So 1 in 2, I mean, that's really, really common. That said, the majority of cases of BV are asymptomatic, and so they don't even get reported because the woman doesn't even know that she has it, and they don't obviously get treated. BV was previously considered to be benign, but recently it's been associated with a lot of gynecological conditions and complications of pregnancy, including pelvic inflammatory disease, post-hysterectomy, vaginal cuff cellulitis, endometriosis, amniotic fluid infection, preterm delivery and labor, preterm rupture of the membranes, and possibly spontaneous abortion, although there's not really enough data to know for sure about that. BV usually involves an overgrowth of gram-negative bacteria and a reduction in the amount of hydrogen peroxide producing lactobacilli, which is one reason that some women use hydrogen peroxide wash as a treatment. BV can resolve and recur spontaneously, but the environment, you know, the behavioral, hormonal, microbial milieu that determine whether it resolves or recurs is not completely clear yet. The most common treatment for BV in the conventional world is Flagyl, which is a pretty heavy drug with a fair amount of side effects. And it's usually fairly effective, but I, of course, worry about the impact of Flagyl on mom's flora, her gut flora and her vaginal flora, and thus the baby's flora. Antibiotics are generally considered to be safe during pregnancy, but safe, really, when drugs are studied in pregnancy, safety profile often really comes down to whether they cause birth defects or not. So antibiotics in most cases haven't been shown to cause any birth defects, but that doesn't mean they don't have other effects that could harm the mother and the baby and possibly much later in life. And what I mean by that is we know now, and I've talked about this before and written about it several times, that the changes in the baby's gut flora at birth can actually affect their lifelong health. It can predispose them possibly to obesity and diabetes and other metabolic problems when they're in their childhood, and even increase their risk of dying from a heart attack under 60 years of age. So it's definitely something that is getting an increasing amount of attention, but still isn't really referred to when in these kind of discussions about the safety of certain drugs during pregnancy. So I would consider other possibilities that might be less harmful to the mom and the baby's microbial environment. And one possible option is monolaurin, which we've talked about before. We talked about it in the episode where I discussed treating viral infections. When lauric acid, which is in mother's milk, and coconut oil is attached to glycerin, it forms a monoglyceride known as monolaurin, and that is effective not only against viruses, which we discussed, and yeast and fungi, but also parasites and bacteria. I haven't seen any studies of monolaurin, the safety of monolaurin in pregnant or lactating women, but it is a component of mother's milk, and it's been used by pregnant and lactating women for years without reported problems. I have seen several studies suggesting that taking probiotics can increase the efficacy of antibiotic treatment of BV, so I'd assume the same would be true with monolaurin. For example, in vitro studies have shown that lactobacillus strains can disrupt BV and yeast biofilms and inhibit the growth of urogenital pathogens. And other studies have found that vaginal probiotic suppositories may also be effective. So I'd probably suggest trying monolaurin and probiotics first. The brand of monolaurin I recommend is lauricidin, and that was developed by the researcher that first isolated monolaurin extract. And it's the most standardized and potent form, I think. So you could take both an oral probiotic and a probiotic in a suppository form. Gero makes a probiotic, specific probiotic called Femdophilus that contains two strains that are particularly beneficial for the vaginal tract. So you could either open some capsules in water and make a douche with that, or you could try a probiotic suppository such as Pure Fem. I think the Gerodof Femdophilus product works pretty well, both orally and in a douche form. So give that a shot and let us know how it works.
Okay, great. Great ideas to start with. Let's move on to the next one. This question comes for all the women out there who might not be having regular periods, even though their overall health markers are okay, and they eat clean paleo, they probably exercise pretty well, and they're trying to mind their stress and their sleep levels.
Yeah, of course, I see a lot of these women in my practice. I get that's, you kind of describe one of my main patient populations. Most of my patients are already on a primal paleo type of diet, and they're already living a pretty healthy lifestyle, but they're still having issues. And problems with the menstrual cycle are one of the main things that I see in my practice. So I'm really a strong believer in testing for this kind of thing. I like to do a full cycling monthly hormone profile where we test estrogen and progesterone levels throughout the entire month. And, you know, a lot of naturopaths and holistic kind of practitioners and some MDs will do this kind of testing. It's really, really important because, as all of you women out there know, I mean, you don't need me to tell you this, your hormones fluctuate throughout the month, right? That's part of the natural cycle. If you look at a chart of what a woman's estrogen and progesterone level should be through the month, it's not a flat line, right? So if you only do a single hormone sample at one day during the month, you're only going to get an idea of what the hormones were on that day. And that's certainly can be useful information, and especially if you time that test in a certain way around day 21, you can get a pretty good idea of what's happening in the luteal phase with progesterone and estrogen, and that can give you a starting place. And I often do that with patients as a beginning thing, just because the monthly test takes a while, and depending on when they come in and when the first day of their next cycle is, it might be, you know, at least 2 months before we get results back. But if you really want an accurate idea of what's happening in with the female hormones, you have to do a monthly cycling panel. And because when you look at a chart of estrogen and progesterone throughout the monthly cycle, you'll see estrogen, they're both fairly low early in the cycle, and then estrogen starts to increase gradually, and then you should see a spike right around mid-cycle, which precedes the LH spike, and that indicates the ovulation has occurred. And then you'll see the estrogen levels kind of taper off a little bit and then increase a little bit and then go down again in the second half of the cycle. So that's an optimal estrogen curve. And then for progesterone, you'll see it kind of stay low the first half of the cycle. And then as soon as ovulation happens, progesterone starts to go up and the corpus luteum is made. And then progesterone stays high, should stay high through most of the second half of the cycle, and then drop along with estrogen right before menses begin again. And what's really incredible to me is now that I've seen so many of these cycling monthly hormone panels is how rare it is to see a woman who actually has a normal graph, you know, a normal estrogen progesterone level in the way that it should look all the way through the cycle. Now, Grant, you have to consider that the women that I see in my practice are dealing with health issues and oftentimes hormone issues. So it's not a representative sample. And surely there are a lot of women out there who have normal hormone levels. But what I mean is that for the women that I'm testing that are complaining of, you know, all of these symptoms that are related to their monthly cycle, it's very common that something is off. And there can be three possible problems, really. And they happen kind of in a sequential way, like from less serious to more serious. So the first thing that tends to happen is that you'll see progesterone levels dropping too early in the later part of the cycle. And that can cause all kinds of problems like PMS. It can spotting, you know, early bleeding. It can cause longer periods, can cause headaches, all of the kind of typical signs of progesterone deficiency. And you can actually even, like if a patient comes in and says, wow, I get these headaches every month. And I say, okay, well, you know, do you chart your cycle? Do you have any idea about that? Oh yeah, I do. Okay. So what day of your, oh, well, geez, now that you mention it, it seems like they always happen on day 24 of my cycle or, you know, day 23. And then we look at the chart and sure enough, on day 23, you can see the progesterone levels dropping out. So that's the first problem. That's a problem of distribution. Like the distribution of progesterone throughout the cycle is not optimal. The second problem is one of production. And that means that not only is the distribution not right of the hormones through the cycle, the overall amount of hormone that's being produced is low. And that usually corresponds to some significant amount of hypothalamic pituitary adrenal stress or fatigue, which a lot of people refer to as adrenal fatigue, because keep in mind that the female hormones don't just go out of balance for no reason. They are usually 7 or 8, 9 times out of 10, they usually go out of balance because something else has happened first, like the adrenals have gone out of whack, because pregnenolone is the precursor hormone to all of the hormones in the body, and it can be either channeled into the DHEA pathway, which goes down to estrogen and testosterone, or it can be channeled into the progesterone pathway, which eventually goes to cortisol. So if a woman is under a lot of stress, either emotional, psychological, or physiological stress, then what's going to happen is something called the pregnenolone steal, where an excessive amount of pregnenolone is stolen or diverted into the cortisol pathway to, you know, help support the stress response. And then there's a lot less left over for sex hormone production and even for progesterone production. So initially in that process, progesterone levels will go up, but over time in that chronic stress response, progesterone levels will eventually go down. Cortisol levels, which were high initially, will start to go down, and then that whole system gets depleted. And then over time, estrogen levels will also start to drop because of the pregnenolone steal. So stage two, you have this problem with production, and it usually corresponds with the adrenal fatigue. So you really have to treat the adrenals along with the female hormones, or it's not going to be a successful treatment. And then the last stage is a timing issue where ovulation is either not happening at all, it's happening too early, or it's happening too late. So then that throws off the whole cycle. And of course, for women who are trying to get pregnant, that's the really important part. And there are things that we can do to push the ovulation forward if it's happening too early, or move it back if it's happening too late, or get it going again if it's not happening at all. So all of this, though, depends on accurate testing. And I should say that in Chinese medicine, there are other ways of diagnosing these problems that use a completely different language, a completely different system of diagnosis, which involves reading the pulses and looking at the tongue. And I've seen that be very effective, both in my own experience and, you know, in working with teachers and mentors when I was in school and things like that. And I do use herbal medicine still in treatment of hormone issues, but I prefer to use modern testing, partly because I work with patients over the phone and it's pretty hard to read their pulse and look at their tongue and do that kind of thing, but also partly because that's just my bent. I'm really more of a functional medicine practitioner than the Chinese medicine guy at this point. So yeah, that's what I would do. Try to find someone that's doing that kind of hormone profile. I think it's really important. Unfortunately, it's not as common as it should be. And so you can maybe ask practitioners, if you're interviewing a practitioner, whether they work with that kind of testing and what kind of treatment they use as a result.
So Chris, I want to get everyone crystal clear here. If you're a woman and you're not experiencing regular periods, is that's a bad sign, right?
I think that's a normal part of female physiology, and that it's from an evolutionary perspective that's part of our developmental history. And I do think it's normal, and I think it usually reflects some kind of hormone imbalance if it's not happening. Obviously, we're talking about premenopausal women. There's a pretty wide difference in age in terms of when women enter menopause. And so we're not really having a discussion about that. We're talking more about younger women who haven't entered menopause that are not cycling normally.
Right. So if you're not cycling normally, that's a bad sign. That's definitely a sign that even though you're doing your best to get your health under control, that there's something else you need to investigate.
Yeah, I think so. It's a sign that more investigation is warranted, and particularly looking at adrenal hormones and sex hormones like estrogen, progesterone.
Okay, so what about PMS symptoms? What's your take on that?
That's very often due to progesterone deficiency. I mentioned those three stages of that we see in the test. And the first stage is a distribution problem where progesterone drops out early in the cycle, or too early in the second phase of the luteal phase of the cycle. And that is very often caused by progesterone deficiency, in my experience. I mean, there are other potential causes, but that's the first thing to look for.
Okay. And I'm just trying to get a little more specific here, because I think a lot of people that I talk with, they're not really sure what optimal is, or like how life could be, such as
right.
having a regular cycle and not having
PMS
problems. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to hear from you just to kind of clarify that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It is possible not to have PMS. I know, difficult to believe for some women, and it's kind of part of the cultural, you know, it's just, we all grow up hearing about it as being almost kind of a normal thing. And I have a lot of women that I treat that don't have PMS even to begin with. And then I have women that have come to me with PMS as a main complaint, and that then after treatment don't have PMS. So yeah, just to make that clear, that, you know, strong PMS symptoms are usually a sign that something's out of balance.
Awesome. Thanks for clearing that up. Okay. You got time for one more, Chris?
Yeah, we can do one more.
Okay. Well, let's wrap this one up for the ladies. Ton of questions come in. What is the best method of birth control?
Yeah, well, first thing I want to say is that as a man, I'm probably not ideally qualified to answer this question. I recognize there are a lot of considerations that go into this, and many of which that I'm not personally familiar with, because I have a different, you know, different body with different
anatomy.
Yeah, exactly. And so I just want to be sensitive to that. But I'll just give you a few things to, you know, a few considerations or things to think about. Number one, as I said, with the PAP pap screen testing, this is really personal, obviously. It depends on so many variables. For example, are you using birth control for protection against an STD? Are you using it for contraception? Are you using it because you have really irregular cycles or painful periods? I mean, there's so many different reasons that women take birth control. So the answer to what's the best form of birth control completely depends on what the goals are, because different goals will lead to different answers, right? Planned Parenthood has a pretty extensive questionnaire that's designed to help women choose what the best form of birth control is based on their preferences and their goals. Like, are they using it for STD protection or for contraception? If someone asked me from a purely health perspective, you know, without taking all of those other things into account, which is, I realize, kind of ridiculous, but if, you know, from a purely health perspective, the fertility awareness method is the best, which is a woman charting her cycle, measuring her basal body temperature, measuring her cervical mucus to determine when she's ovulating, and then avoiding intercourse, you know, within a few days before ovulation and a few days after ovulation. But of course, this method is far from foolproof as a method of contraception, and it's best used by people who could live with getting pregnant, you know, for people for whom getting pregnant wouldn't be a terrible thing or the end of the world. You know, maybe a couple that is not planning on getting pregnant, but if they got pregnant, they would welcome the conception. Of the other methods, you know, that have a higher, that are safer from a contraceptive standpoint, the cervical cap or the diaphragm might be the safest from the health perspective after the fertility awareness method, along with the man wearing a condom, and those could be with or without spermicide. And then there's the copper IUD, which has a success, well, about 6 of 1,000 women who use that become pregnant in the first year of using it. So pretty good odds, but you know, I'm sure most women know that there's always a chance with most forms of contraception of it not working. So I would love to hear from other women, from women out there, and maybe women who have a particular expertise in this subject area. Maybe you could post something on my Facebook page or on Twitter, or submit an email through the contact form on my website. This is something I'd like to learn more about. So if you have any wisdom to share on this topic, I'd be happy to hear it.
And I'm sure we'll be all happy to learn about whatever your expertise is. And I know nothing, so I just default to Chris. So,
well, I know a little bit more, but still, I definitely don't consider myself to be an expert in that area. So, all right, I think that's where I was going to stop. It's a nice sunny day out there. I'm going to go lay in the sun and get some vitamin D and rest a little bit.
All right, great. Well, I hope that the rest of the family gets well soon, and you can get some rest. And we'll be talking again soon for our next episode.
Sounds good.
I want to thank you for listening today. Please keep sending us your questions to chriskresser.com using the podcast submission link. If you enjoyed the show, please head over to iTunes and leave us a review. It helps get the word out and spread the show to others who might be helped by it.